I just wanted to tell you that I love being together with you. I was thinking about that during Chris. Where'd Chris go? He had a potty break, so we can talk about him. Chris is the smartest guy that I know, I think. I asked him this morning if he could fill in for communion today, so that was just kind of off the cuff that he was sharing with us. And I hope that you all feel this, but it is a blessing to be part of this church. And I get the opportunity to kind of stand up here every week and just look out and be reminded of all the people that make our church wonderful. And with us having been gone a couple weeks ago, it's just really a good thing to be together. And we have a lot of folks that are gone and doing a couple things this morning. And I just encourage you to try to touch base. And I know our small group time is really a great time to be able to do that. So don't know why, I just felt like saying that today. I have a weird habit that I do. Probably a lot if you talk to my wife. One of the weird things I do is I've always done this since I preached my first sermon when I was about 15 years old in the YMCA in Defiance, Ohio at a lock-in sermon, talk, whatever. And I still have the copy. It was handwritten somewhere. So that would have been like in 1995, 96, back in the 1900s, as Clark would say. I've always just numbered my talks forever. I've just kept track. So you don't care, but this is my 383rd sermon this morning. About 350 of them have probably been here. You've heard me talk way too much is one of the things I want to say. For some reason, and I don't know that I really felt this way until I got here this morning, I think the things that I want to share with you this morning are some of the most important things that I've ever preached about. I really believe that. And I think some of you are probably going to connect and think, it was okay, you know. But I wanted to preface it. Before I say anything else this morning, I want to convey to you that I really feel like the things we're going to talk about this morning are just about as important of a conversation as we've had. And I say that because we're going to laugh a lot and say some funny things, and we're going to watch a video here in a second that's pretty funny, and you're probably going to not buy it at first. But hang with me through the end. And Randy, you picked the song that was perfect today, and I hadn't really thought about it until we were singing it, so we're going to come back to that in a minute. But the first thing is, so Minslers are here, and I've been kind of wondering about this. What we've been doing is we've been reading a book of the Bible every month. You chose the Song of Solomon month, so off we go. I just kind of wondered for visitors, like, all right, so our Song of Solomon sermon this morning. Look, we're not very familiar with this book, and so we're spending about 3 weeks on it, and there are times where it speaks so much directly to us, and there are times when it's hilarious because it's just so out of context. I don't know if you've seen this video. It's been around for a few years. It's pretty funny. Clark, go ahead and show this, and then we'll get started today.
Thank you.
So stupid. But it was perfect. I mean, how often are we going to have a series about the Song of Solomon? If we're ever going to show the video, right? We had to show it now. But he brings out, the whole idea brings out a reality of the Song of Solomon. As you're reading through it, and we talk about how romantic it is and how sexually charged it is, there are parts of it that you read, and you're like, this is the exact opposite of what I feel like would be attractive. And this is kind of, I like to go off the cuff a little bit, but Nathan Menzler is here. Hey, would you come up here? Now Nathan and Claire are kind of, you know, friendly as of late. And so I just kind of felt like it might be good for you to channel your inner, like, masculinity and share a couple. I picked out some of the best lines that I think this would help Claire. Claire drove to church today, so she's a little, you know, this will help soothe her, help her whenever. But if you could just read these four right here, and if you could look into her eyes.
Hi, Claire.
Okay. So the stage is yours, man. Yeah, this is not rehearsed. He's not ready for this. Yeah. Oh, it's getting hot in here. Okay, this is my favorite one. So really, this is the one that I think is the money verse here. This is from the Bible, so it's okay. You can read it. What does that even mean? All right, don't read the other ones. Then your parents are going to be up here, and it'll be awkward. Okay. So you just can't help but read through it, and you know it's, I mean, this is erotic literature. Like, this is saucy stuff. We're kind of editing our comments today because the kids are with us. They've got children's worship next week, and we can get back to the real stuff. But you read some of it, and you go, yeah, I think it's lost in translation. Even when you read Jane Austen or Shakespeare and some of the really good moments in those, you understand what they're saying, but it's lost. However, at the same time, there are some other verses, and I didn't want to really embarrass you. Listen to these. This is straight out of the Song of Solomon. I don't care what century it is. This is pretty sexy stuff. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. It sounds like Shakespeare, right? How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. How handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming. Show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Now these, Nathan, are some stuff that you probably could use, right? Like, this is tender, beautiful verses. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. This is in the Bible. My lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. Tyus is back there taking notes. Hey, man. I'll give you the verses later. This is great. If you're a romantic, like I know there's a lot of guys in here that are romantics that don't want anybody to know that you're romantic. So just kind of keep this in mind, right? Turn your eyes from me. They overwhelm me. I mean, ladies, if a guy says that to you, like, be still my heart, right? Like, this is great stuff. Leave the flock of goats stuff aside. Like, you don't want that. Probably my favorite. This is pretty saucy. Your lips drip sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. Holy smokes. There's no doubt what he's saying there. Chris Lewis, shuffle that one away for later, right? That one's a little love note before you leave tomorrow. How beautiful you are and how pleasing, O love, with your delight. I mean, it's just beautiful language. And I know when you read it, you see that, you know, your breasts are like two fawns and you're going, that's not going to work. But in the midst of all of those kind of poetic verses that may not translate so well, there's real beauty in this letter. And I don't care what century you are, those last ones are amazing. But we're talking about something. We introduced this topic last week and I said, look, whether you're married or you're not, if you've ever been married, just about everybody has had the experience of somewhere in their life just falling under the spell of somebody, right? sometimes it's so innocent that that other person never even knows it. But somewhere in late elementary or middle school, it just happens. And it's so difficult for us to convey that message that we've come up with a wealth of idioms to try to convey what we're saying. And so we say, oh, you came under the spell of someone. Being drunk with love. Having a crush on someone. I mean, we use these all the time, but stop and think about what they're really saying. To fall in love is an idiom. To fall head over heels is an idiom. To be smitten by someone, that's a little more Shakespearean, right? To find your soulmate. To be having your breath taken away. To have the hots for somebody. To be joined at the hip. And my personal favorite, and all guys that lived in dorms who live with someone who found their special one, they come back in and all the guys say, man, you're whipped, right? And then there's the words of the great philosopher of our time. The power of love is a curious thing. Make a one man weep, make another man sing. Change a heart to a little white dove. More than a feeling, it's the power of love, right? And all these younger people are out there going, what are they talking about? Don't need money, don't need fame, don't need no credit card. Okay, off we go, right? I know not everybody has had that feeling, but most everybody, even if you've never been involved in a relationship, you felt the pitter-patter of your heart. And I know I've made this point before. You know, love is one of those things where you can look at the history of the world, and the dumbest things that have ever been done in the history of the world have probably been done by somebody, usually a guy, who's in love with a woman. And off they go. All of our stories are full of this complicated thing that we call love. But as you read through the Song of Solomon, there is three times where a refrain appears that it's probably easy to overlook because of all the other stuff that's there, the good stuff, right? But three times, in the first instance is in Song of Solomon chapter 2 and verse 7, the writer says, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles. There's the gazelles and does again. Okay, they show up a lot in there. I charge you by the gazelles and the does on the field. And this is what he says. It's the first time, but it happens three different times in the Song of Solomon. He says, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Now, for the most part, the Song of Solomon is this love letter between the beloved and the lover, a man and a woman who are just flowing, smattering love letters back and forth. And there are some friends and there are some of these daughters of Jerusalem, these people that kind of sit on the sides, and they kind of chime in once in a while about how beautiful it is to see the love enacted there and how wonderful their love is. And, you know, it's kind of like the best friends of the homecoming king and queen that are just, oh, isn't it beautiful? But at three different times, they are charged not to arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Now, it's difficult to know exactly what that means because we don't have a lot of context. You know, this is just a love letter, basically. But as you consider the power of love that Huey Lewis and the news chime about, it's something that we all realize is awfully powerful. It's set off the course of events in people's lives. They have things all set. They get smitten by someone, and it changes the course of their life forever. Maybe it's happened to you. It probably happened to us, I guess. Mary Beth had such wonderful goals in life, and then I came along and stole her heart, and she's had to settle for Ohio, where at least we have a good football team, if nothing else, right? Now, I could stand up here this morning and tell you that I fully understand exactly what's going on in here. Do not arouse or awaken love. Now, it happens three times in the book, and you may think, well, there's only eight chapters in the book. And there's this refrain that happens three different times. And I could stand up here all day and talk about all the different ways that we've manipulated and messed up the romantic and sexual relationships in our world. Consider the ways that we could talk about abuse within this relationship. The ways that we could talk about neglect in this relationship. Impropriety. and excess. If we just took those four words and then drew lines about how that is connected to a romantic or sexual relationship. Some people have so corrupted the idea of love and romance that it seems like every week I read a story in the newspaper and it just makes you shudder about the abuses that take place in the world around us. This week alone, kids are in here, so we won't even talk about the news, but this week alone, three or four stories of kidnappings and things. And so often, it's rooted in this whole discussion, is it not? While the Song of Solomon fills a really important subject and kind of addresses an issue that we so often neglect, I think it's also easy to come away with this book or from this book and feel like if you're not married, if you haven't experienced a traditional marriage, if half of what I'm saying when I say, well, most everybody, and you're sitting there going, well, not me, it's easy to come away and think that you're somehow lacking or insufficient or not equaled with everyone else, that somehow you're damaged, that somehow you're not experiencing life as fully as those who are married. And if we're to be completely frank and honest, the conversations at churches all over the country almost always neglect the folks who aren't married and focus on how great it is to be married and how great it is to have kids. And that's what most of us experience. And everybody else on the outside looking in has to wonder, what about me? And so let me provide my full disclosure first. I am 37 years old. I'm at the point in life where I have to think about it a little bit more than I used to. I've been married for almost 17 years. I have a funny story about that. I was in Paris. We were in Paris a couple weeks ago, and we were hanging out at Versailles. I know this is like sounds like the snootiest story ever. So we were at Versailles, and we were hanging out with some friends. We're hanging out with some of Merrick's friends, and this guy comes up, and we were talking, because they all pretty much speak English. And he was a little bit younger than me, probably around his 30s, early 30s. And his girlfriend was pregnant with their first child. And so we strike up a conversation about marriage and friendship and all this kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, I'm married. Well, how long have you been married? And I said, well, it would be 17 years in December. And he like looked at me and almost shouted, how old are you? Because folks over there don't get married until they're in their 30s. And I think most of you realize that in the United States, most people wait longer and longer and longer. And so I'm just telling you my story. I was 20 years old when I got married. We were 19, right, and we got engaged. She was maybe a little older, but that's okay. But think about this. So I was 19 when we first got together. Next year I'll be 38. That means, right, half my life, just about, has been connected to her. And I was 19, and apparently I grew up a lot faster than most 19-year-olds, because I see 19-year-olds now, and I'm like, I didn't look like that. I wasn't like that. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I know anything about being single for very long. My whole adult life I've been married. Mary Beth found this kid from Ohio, and we got married, and I don't really understand the first thing about being single. And so I can't stand up here and tell you, those of you who are not married, that I understand your situation, that I can speak to it, or really just about anything about it. And so I have to fully disclose that, and I also have to acknowledge that that's where most of my stories come from, that's most of what I talk about, because that's the life that I know. And I think that as a church, and I can speak on behalf of at least our church, and say, I think we should apologize to the folks who are single for whatever reason and say we don't allow enough opportunities for you to connect with the bigger story. It's unfortunate that we've allowed so much of the narrative of the church to be only from married people. Think about all of the different situations that people may find themselves in. We have people who are divorced. We have people who are widowed. We have people who struggle with same-sex attraction. We have people who are single by choice. There are people who are single not by choice. There are people who are not mentally or physically capable of being in a relationship with someone else. Probably other situations that I'm not even thinking of. There's all of these folks in these situations, and they must feel, you must feel, those of you here today, like the conversation is foreign a lot of times, especially when we're reading through a book like the Song of Solomon, and we talk about how wonderful marriage is and how beautiful it is and how wonderful it's to be with somebody. And I just have to, as best as I can, put myself in your position and think about hearing the verse, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." One of the most important things I think that the Song of Solomon teaches us, or that we gather from it, is it doesn't glamorize sex as the most important thing in the world. Now, what does is every rap song that you may hear, or every country music song that you may hear, or just pretty much every song that you hear on the radio, or in every television show you watch on TV, and every movie you go to, the message of our culture is that this is where it's at. This is the greatest feeling. It's the most important thing in your life. And the Song of Solomon revels in the beauty of it, in the mystery of it, in the eroticism of it, but it never says, "And this is the greatest thing in the world." And it's unfortunate that that's the message that begins to creep into the church. And it begins to creep into people's messages about the church. And suddenly, we're missing something here. Sex in the Song of Solomon is no casual topic. It's not a casual encounter. Even though we may not understand all the analogies and allegories that are used, it's pretty clear that this is a really intensely committed relationship, and that they're deeply and vastly in love with each other. And it's not a hookup, and it's not a Tinder match, and it's none of that stuff. This is a really deep, deep connection. It's the power of love. Man, we're all going to have that song in our head the rest of the day. One of the most countercultural messages, I think, in the entire Bible comes out of the Song of Solomon. And it comes out of this idea of not awakening love until it desires. I think if I'm single, which I was for like 19 years, you know, a blip on the radar. I think if I'm single and I'm reading this verse, at some point you've got to ask yourselves, well, when is it going to desire, right? When does love awaken? When is it appropriate? Because there's a whole lot of other things inside of me that say now. And it should be this way, or it should be that way. And the Bible comes along, and just before the Song of Solomon in Ecclesiastes, there's this beautiful kind of oration that's become famous, where it talks about there being a season and a time for everything. And one of the things that it mentions is that there's a time to embrace, and there's a time to refrain. And if you listen to our culture, they would say there is definitely a time to embrace, and do a whole lot of other stuff. Don't worry about refraining. We're not a culture of refrainment. And so the necessary question for, I think, especially folks who are single or find themselves in a different position is, what if it's never your time or season? What if you feel this way about someone who is the same member of the same sex as you are? What if you've been raped or abused and you feel like this entire part of your life is broken beyond repair? What if you've been in many relationships and they all just don't work out? You start to wonder, I don't want to hear anymore about the right one or there being still someone out there. And on and on and on we could go with the conversations and the situations that so many of us may be facing. And I think it's all a disservice to bring up all these questions and acknowledge all these situations of life that so many people find themselves and then just kind of move on and talk about something else. But I kind of am afraid that that's what we're going to end up doing this morning. You see, it's easy to quote from Genesis, which we did last week, right? That was our reading. First Genesis, chapter 1 of Genesis. Man and a woman leave their parents to be united together, and isn't it a beautiful thing? And it's easy to walk away from that, I can see, as a single person and think, what about me? We forget, and Trisha's face was so great when she came in this morning, because I emailed her the text and she said, is this what I'm supposed to read? And I said, oh yeah, you got this, it's great. And she made it through, and it's uncomfortable, but at the end of that passage, We never read this, where Paul says, I wish that everybody was like me, and like me means not married, single, so they could busy themselves with the kingdom work. How often do we read Genesis 1 saying how beautiful and wonderful marriage is, to the neglect of Paul saying, you know what, it's great too, but I wish you all would just stay single because the calling of God is so much greater and higher. It's unfortunate that we as a church have lost our message when it comes to the realities of marriage and romantic relationships. It's not for everyone. It's just not. And the history of the church has a long history of people saying, I choose to be celibate because of my relationship with God. And there's other people who have not wanted to choose that, but have found themselves devoted to God wholly anyways, and it may be in spite of what their wishes and desires were. I don't know what I'm talking about most of the time, but especially this morning. And I've tried to convey that to you. And so I went out and I reached out a couple places online. And I found a minister in another part of the country. And I just conveyed, it was a minister's group of different ministers from all over. And I said, look, I'm preaching this topic, and I really don't know what to say. I don't know what to convey. And he wrote me back, and we've kind of struck up a little bit of a relationship about this whole matter. And I asked if I could share some of the things that he said. And so I would encourage you, particularly if you do find yourself single today, to listen to these words, because Adam doesn't know what he's talking about here, and I can't speak firsthand. This guy can. And so let me just read the things that he shared with us. The Song of Solomon is especially for you, I believe. I circled the wrong paragraph. I was like, he didn't say that. I said that. I'm 42 years old. Okay, that's not me. This is him speaking. I'm 42 years old. I've never had sex. I'm a virgin. And I'm very thankful for that. So let's just stop there and let that soak in. How many times have you heard anybody say that? Ever? 42-year-old virgin sounds like a movie, right? A comedy, right? Like, oh yeah, it's already been done. And that dictates the conversation in our culture and therefore dictates the culture of our churches. Here is a Christian who wants to say something different. I'm 42 years old. I've never had sex. I'm a virgin. And I'm very grateful for that. Yeah, you heard me right. I'm sure sex is wonderful. Lots of people tell me so. But I also think that I'm wonderful, and I have that on good authority. So how did I get to be so wonderful and not be engaging in this wonderful thing? Isn't it now and always been about God delighting in me? He delights in my single life, regardless of whether that starts from the point of sexual abuse, same-sex attraction, divorce, a one-night stand, or 42 years of celibacy, when all my heart and soul are given in devotion to him, he delights. Sure, I sometimes covet what you married folks have, but that feeling doesn't usually last. What matters is that I'm overwhelmed by God's blessing. I'm in awe of his presence. This may be overly simplistic, but from a single man's perspective, what I love hearing about is the gift of singleness, the joys of singleness, the unique expression of my singleness in God's kingdom. I would love hearing that, how all you married people are missing out on what I have for a change. And he put about 6 exclamation points there. I've heard a bazillion lessons on the ideals of marriage and about 0 on the joys, gifts, opportunities, and adventures of singleness. And I don't want to hear about it as a concession, as if I'm somehow sort of a consolation prize. In short, I love hearing about how my life is uniquely organized to provide holy space for me to be wholly devoted to God. Married or single, the sexualized crap remains the same. But casting a vision for the good, I believe that in itself is a reflection of God's goodness. But casting a vision, an abstinent life, regardless of your starting point, when given to God, is a wonderful thing. Just one single man's perspective. We have to be careful when we're raising our children, when we're presenting the image of what the future may hold. Singleness is okay. It's better than okay. And that was my biggest fear as I knew that this was a topic that we were going to talk about. My biggest fear was that somehow I was going to convey that singleness is a concession. That it's pretty good, but it's not as good as maybe you could be. And what I appreciate about this guy's perspective is that he says, it's not a concession. How about we hear how great my life is because I'm single and the great things I'm able to do in the kingdom because I'm single, instead of always hearing about how great it is to be married and have kids and on we go with all that story. There is another story, and all of you who don't fit into that category, I hope that you'll hear those words and take them to heart. And if you really feel like you need somebody who can speak on better authority, like I said, I can do the best I can, but my experience is what I have. I'd be more than happy to put you in contact with this guy. Has a real heart for this message, and I think, and again, I just think the church has to apologize and say, man, we've become so obsessed. And I know that a lot of you are married right now, and you're thinking, this is a great message for all those single folks. Well, just stop and think if that's how you felt 90% of the time instead of the other way around. All the times we talk about marriage and relationships and working through stuff and all that stuff, which is really important, and we're going to get more into that next week. But just stop and think and consider the folks among us who sit there every week like you are right now going, that's a great message for the other half of the church. But as I started considering all the different situations that people find themselves in, and I didn't even mention the younger kids among us who aren't even married yet, if you throw them in, that's half our church. That's half of our church who's sitting here week in and week out feeling like maybe this is a concession or maybe not so much related to them. And so what I really want to stop and focus on here for the last couple minutes here, what does the Song of Solomon say to you then if you are single? What's the point of this book? Is it one that you get to be a certain age and go, well, probably not going to get married. I'll just throw this one out because it doesn't really matter. The fact of the matter is, it's telling us a message, and I think he did a good job of in his statements there kind of conveying this, is sex and romance is not an end in itself. It's simply another experience in our lives that's pointing us beyond. It's pointing us to God. And there's a lot of things in our life that we don't all share the same things, but they're pointing us to God, whether it's nature or, you know, you can just fill in the list of the ways, and we've talked about that before, when we feel closest to God. Well, for some of us, it's an intimate moment with our spouses, and that's good and that's holy, but it's not the only way. And so there's a number of people out there who are struggling in this area of their lives. Either they're frustrated and upset with having not found someone to spend their lives with, or their history is full of broken relationships and finding the wrong guy or the wrong girl. Whether it's having feelings for somebody who's of the same sex and not sure what to do with them and how that works itself out. Whether there's been abuse in the past and just feels so broken. And those folks are sitting here and they're looking for something. And the sexual relationship and the intimacy of a marriage is not where they see God, because they don't experience that. But, as we all probably know, still have those feelings. Still feel that desire to want to be that close to someone. And so, Clark, are you still awake up there? I know your dad's talking about this. You just want to try to phase it out. Go back a couple songs to, what is it, Randy? I'm running. What is the name of that song? Forever Rain. Go back to Forever Rain. Okay, right there. Stop right there. So with everything I just said, I want you to listen and hear the words of this song, because this is the perfect song. This is exactly what this message is supposed to convey. And I don't know how well I've done it, but this song will do it well. This is a song not to your spouse, not to your parents, not to your kids, not to your family, not to somebody who's so precious to you. This is a song to God. I'm running to your arms. The riches of your love will always be enough. If I'm single, if I get divorced, if my spouse dies, if I don't find anybody, if all the ifs, the riches of your love will always be enough. Go to the next slide, Clark. Nothing compares to your embrace. So all you married folks, you know what that's saying, right? Nothing in your relationship with your spouse compares to the embrace of the Holy One. And that's a message we just aren't saying enough. Because everybody out there is running for sex in so many different ways because they feel like there's an emptiness inside of them. And it's a great feeling, and it's a powerful feeling. And we want so badly to have it filled. And it may be by a number of people. It may be whatever. But what this song says and what the Song of Solomon testifies to is that nothing compares to the embrace of the Holy One. Light of the forever, light of the world forever. I think when you put it in the context of the Song of Solomon, it completely changes the meaning of that verse, or at least gives it a lot more meaning than what I've felt when I've sung that before. I want to end by telling you about a one-minute story about a guy named Brian Keenan. He was held hostage in Lebanon back in the 80s. A lot of you remember those hostages that were held by militant Islamic folks. He was held for about 4 years. He'd been beaten, abused. He had been held in isolation, and if you read very much about kidnappings, that's one of the worst things you can do to somebody is just put them in isolation and just have to live by yourself. So after 4 years, he was released, and he reflected on his time in captivity, and he said, I found a lot of safety and security and reassurement by reading the book of Psalms, which probably doesn't surprise any of us. I mean, that would be probably the book. Hey, John, you're going to be kidnapped tomorrow. You can take one book of the Bible with you. That's the one, right? First of all, it's the stupidest illustration ever because on a lot of reasons, right? The Psalms we understand. But he also said this, which I find really interesting. The gentle eroticism of the Song of Songs was a reassuring comfort to him. And I think that language is a wonderful description of the Song of Solomon. A gentle eroticism. When you see sex depicted in our culture today, gentle is not a word that I often think of. Gentle eroticism. And there's something about being isolated and alone and cast away from people. And as he reflected on his relationship with God, there's some element of eroticism to it. And it sounds weird to me too, I get that. But there's something in that feeling. There's something in that experience in all of us, no matter where we find ourselves in this whole discussion, that's pointing us to the intimacy of God. That's pointing us to how well God knows us. And so with all that in context, imagine a lover who says this, or is it this as an experience. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You've perceived my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all of my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in and behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to heaven, that you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you're there. If I rise in the wings of dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me. I can get away from Mary Beth if I need to. Sometimes she needs to get away from me. Imagine the lover where you say, I can't go anywhere. You're always there. You know my thoughts. And so if you find yourself single, I want to relay what he said in his letter to us. You're not missing anything. You have all of those experiences wrapped up in the relationship that you have with God. He knows you that deeply. And I hope that will inform us in our minds as we stand. And we're going to sing this last song. And it's another song that, we kind of laughed last week about picking songs for this topic. But there's more overlap than maybe what you first realize. And so, Randy, if you want to come up and the team wants to come up, if you guys want to stand, and we'll sing this last song. And hopefully you'll keep in mind the things that we've shared this morning.